Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. You're going to hear from Pat this week, and we have a new segment. I'm calling it Fantastic Foresight. It contains, well, basically, it's a segment on the Fantastic Four, and it features Mr. Steve Raker, Mr. Alan White, and Mr. Chris Campbell, and they're going to talk about some current Fantastic Four goings on, and take a look at some Fantastic Four history. So we're gonna get to the good stuff, and then I'll come back once that's all done, and talk about a couple things I've been reading.
This is Pat Loika, and I'm here to talk to you about a book that I picked up recently, and it's the X-Men Omnibus Volume 2 by Chris Claremont and Jim Lee. Now, if you're like me and you grew up in the reading comics in the late 80s, early 90s, then you know this stuff is sacred. there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's a pretty sacred run. This particular volume collects the Savage Land storyline with Magneto and Rogue and Kazar and Nick Fury, all that stuff, and the Zavodane story. This also includes the Muir Island saga, the Apocalypse story from X Factor, where that Will Sportacio illustrated that featured the story where young Nathan Summers was given to the Ascani to be brought to the future, and the rest is history, if you know what I mean. This also includes the first 11 issues of X-Men by Chris Claremont and Jim Lee. Soon he was joined by Scott Lobdell, and it's a beloved run from the early 90s with some of the best Jim Lee art we've seen, even to this day, honestly. This book, not only does it contain all these stories, there's over 20 issues worth of content in here. But then you get to the bonus features. The bonus features are the best part. And as much as I love the stories, they went all out here with the bonuses. Because, among other things, you get the entire over 100-plus cards from the Marvel X-Men trading card set that Jim Lee drew with colors by Paul Mount. Seriously, this entire thing, it collects not only the art, the fronts of the cards, it also has the backs of the cards and with the power ratings and stuff. And it includes the original art for the holograms and all the bonus material everything from that set is reprinted here. Plus they also reprint various posters. They reprint the posters from X-Men number 1, both in its original color and in the recolored version by Tom Mason. This also has covers from stuff like Marvel Age magazine and Amazing Heroes, like covers and pinups that Jim Lee had done for those magazines. And it's pretty astounding. There's also articles and man, there's just too much for this in this thing. It's pretty steep in price. It's $125. But if you go to places like In Stock Trades or cheapgraphicnovels.com, you can get it for like 40-45% off. So look for this book because it's amazing. It's probably it's a perfect keepsake for anyone who is a fan of that era's X-Men. And moving on from that, I did want to talk briefly about a book that I have been enjoying. Uncanny X-Men has been great under Kieron Gillen's hand. The first story arc with Mr. Sinister has come to a conclusion, and we've had a follow-up story about the Phalanx, and we just started a new story arc which deals with some of the aftermath of the story in Uncanny X-Force, the Dark Angel saga. If you have never been a fan of, if you've never read any of Kieron Gillen's X-Men, now's a good time. The all issues of this title are available at the Marvel app or Comixology, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's fun. It's a high stakes, big X-Men team. The team comprises of Cyclops, of course, Emma Frost, Magneto, Colossus slash Juggernaut, Magic, and Danger, and Hope, and Namor. Namor and Hope actually have some of the best moments in the books, and they're so funny, and they really play off each other. Uncanny X-Men is great. You should be reading it, and that's it. Well, that's it for me for now. I'll be back in the next show, and I'll probably spend more time talking about something that I've read. I might go over the Dark Angel saga and see how it would affect the rest of the Marvel Universe, and particularly the X-Men books, because the effects of that are already being felt in both of the main X-Men titles. So until then, you guys take it easy, and I will talk to you soon.
Blast off with the Fantastic Four! Oh boy, hold on to your seats. This is going to be a good one.
Hey, Baxter Building tenants. Time Variance Authority agents Steve Raker, Alan White, the New Mutant, and Catalyst Chris Campbell here from the Comic Book Bunker with a Fantastic Forecast, professing some love for the world's greatest comic magazine, the Fantastic Four. This is going to be fun, guys.
I know. Absolutely, man.
I know this.
Thanks for the wonderful introduction. A couple of days ago, I was going to IKEA, and I thought, I was listening to a podcast, like, you know, not only do people not talk about Fantastic Four issues regularly, just kind of randomly, but there's
which
no
is people. A crime, which is a crime,
but, you know,
arrest them.
But, you know, I mean, people, Alan, maybe not, but people loving Hickman's run. It's certainly got as much attention as anything has in the last 5 years, and even with that, people still hardly talk about it. I mean, put the death issue aside, and you know, that's kind of a shame when the only time people are talking about it is when it's kind of a cheap issue, you know. And I wanted to actually talk to my buddies about, you know, old FF, new FF, you know, and just get together once a month or so, talk about the new issues, and then kind of pick an era or a creator from the past and just kind of walk down memory lane, about what we liked, what we didn't like. And, you know, I think the first one we have today is perfect. I was in freshman year in high school, and Walt Simonson, that's who we're going to be talking about today. So I'm really excited. I think Alan brings a wonderful perspective to our discussions here.
In other words, I'm going to set it off. That's what you're saying.
How long have you been reading the series?
My first FF that I bought was off the spinner rack. The number is 175.
Wow.
So you do the math, because I'm not trying to do the math on that.
That's around that same era that I started picking up the books. And I was also reading the reprints through Marvel's Greatest Comics. Was that what it was called?
World's greatest.
Look at us.
Remember when Marvel had all those good reprint issues in the 70s? And so I was getting a good dose of the Kirby, as well as finding where the FF was finding its ground post Kirby time there around that 170 time. Chris, I didn't know you were such a youngin'.
Yeah, well,
he's just a baby.
I started reading. I forget what issue it is. It was about 86 or so, 85 or 86. So, I mean, yeah, I'm a youngin', but that was still, 25 years ago.
An old soul.
My prime reading was during Onslaught.
Wow.
That's when I really started getting into it and, you know, going back and getting the older issues. I mean, because, you know, on the spinner rack, can't get every issue. The one nice thing was about Fantastic Four not being, you know, Art Adams X-Men, which we'll talk about art later, is that it was available, you know. I mean, I'm not saying it was the last book left on the spinner rack, but, you know, unless it was a really special issue, you know, you could get it. And so that's the nice thing. But, I mean, the other thing is the issues really weren't hyped up by the speculator market. So in the 90s when I went back and got, you know, a lot of them, they were all very cheap.
Dollar bin,
50-cent bin. Yeah, I mean, I think I need about 30 issues, and I'll have every single one. So.
Every single Fantastic Four ever?
Ever.
All right. Respect.
I'm twiddling my fingers. Yeah, I'll tell you. Next episode, we'll talk about how I got my FF1. It's a very touching story. Generosity and McDonald's. Anyway, so, okay, well, do we guys want to just start talking about the current issues? This is the nice thing. We only have two FF issues.
Sure. I mean, the new stuff has certainly been polarizing, surprisingly to me, especially with so many longtime readers, you know, getting a funny taste in their mouth about it. You know, like Vince B over at 11 o'clock, you know, who always read the FF, like myself, and sounds like you guys as well. Then Alan himself had issues that we've discussed many times on the forums, and I've been waiting for a chance to get him on to talk about FF. So this is going to be the perfect opportunity.
About it in Baltimore, Alan.
Yeah, we did. I don't think I'm going to repeat many of the things that I said there.
Drinks here.
But I did kind of unleash it on another program of a couple of nights ago.
Go ahead, get the plug.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's called Whale Watchers.
Whale Watchers?
Well, like gotcha. Like you dip water from it in the backyard, a well. And the watcher, like Oatu. Yeah, so it's Whale Watchers, and if you go to iTunes and you just put in Whale Watchers, that's one word, Whale Watchers, you will get it. You will find it.
Cool beans. Yeah, so,
theory. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Steve.
Go for it.
Well, this is before the death issue, or actually it's after the death issue, but before everything else, and I had a theory that didn't turn out to be accurate, but I thought that what they were going to do is bring him back. He wasn't really dead. And instead, he hooked up with, like, the underground negative zone, like, resistance movement that was Star-Lord and Nova, and they weren't really dead either, but sure. They were in the negative zone.
Everyone who was lost.
Like, they were, like, guerrilla warfare against Annihilus, and then eventually somehow win. So it was the Light Brigade instead of Star-Lord and Nova, and he really kind of didn't escape. But anyway, we knew he was coming back. But all right,
let's give the spoiler alert too, because we definitely want to be able to talk about this stuff. Not only to get Alan's perspective on what he is or not digging about the current direction, but also we're trying to sell Alan on this. So,
good luck.
So spoiler alert. But yeah, like you said, I mean, we got to mention that Johnny Storm was lost because it matters here. And I got to just say about the death thing again that. If you got stuck into the whole way that marketing marketed it and ended the book and started up the new FF book and all that business, I think you had the opportunity to let it get away from you a little bit. And if you just stuck with the story, it was really well done and more like rather than it being Johnny dead because they never really showed his death per se, it was more like Johnny was lost to the team.
Which is not something new.
Exactly, and he was the youth and the kind of the literal and figurative spark of the team, and it was interesting to see where things went from there, and I think things really picked up from that point. Here we are with the issue of his dramatic return. I gotta say, I think the weakest part of this issue 601 of Fantastic Four is the cover. The rest of it, the art, the presentation, it really, I was hook, line, and sinker the whole issue on the edge of my seat.
Which one?
The thing cover.
Oh, you wound me. It's a little, it looks like he's made out of crinkled garbage bags.
Or overcut clay, you know?
Yeah, and that have that hardness.
That color scheme is Maury Hollowell, right?
Yeah, and it's a Mike Joy cover, and I'm used to seeing his, I think it's his wife, Sonia Oback, doing the colors on his work, and seeing Maury's work, who I like elsewhere, I'm just not sure it was the best match here.
The rendering is great. I mean, his facial expression, the hand positions, it's great. I mean, I like it. I don't think it's awful, but it might be the colors. It does look kind of like folded up tissue paper. But it is a fantastic issue. Do we want to run through what happened quickly, or do you want to just kind of hit some of your favorite points?
Go whatever you'd like to do, Chris.
Well, you know, a lot happens, actually, in this. But I'll just say right away, and then maybe we'll give an overview of it, is it starts off with Johnny, who looks like Steve Rogers, by the way. holding Annihilus with a leash. And that's how everyone sees him. And what's that on his arm? Is that the control rod? Did he make it part of his arm? Or did he put it in the sleeve there?
Yeah,
it's almost like he kind of put it in the sleeve.
Yeah, I think it's a sleeve.
He's got a Witchblade thing going on, for sure. I really like being able to see the moment of Johnny's return through Peter's eyes, through Spider-Man's eyes, because, you know, he's the everyman, you know? And he's the one who's not used to dealing with these big, dramatic, you know, universe-shattering moments, at least when Spider-Man's at his best. So to get to see Spidey speechless and Johnny standing over him and Johnny saying, "What are you wearing?" you know, in regards to Spidey's white FF costume was really
that,
cool.
In that much, I agree with Johnny. I would have said the same thing and have said it.
I also like the very offhanded line, "Here, hold my Annihilus." Where yeah, hands.
Exactly.
He's still Johnny, you know? He's been through like a 2-year stay in the negative zone because time moves differently and he's been at war. But
3 years older or so?
So he's a little more hardened and you know, he's finally home, so this is his relief. He's a little more confident than we're used to seeing him, but he still has those little one-liners.
Can I call him Johnny Rogers? Is that okay?
Sure. Is it because Steve Epting's drawing him and you're so used to Epting on Cap?
I mean, he looks like Steve Rogers, which is not a problem, but...
All right, so
why don't you do a quick, just so people haven't read this, do a quick quick summary of what happens, because a lot happens in this issue.
Yeah, well, we got Johnny coming back here. We get a great moment of him sort of alerting the world of his return by making a flaming four in the sky, and certainly I thought everyone's panel's reactions to that. They're all in battle with a Kree army because the Kree is invading the Earth. So it's chaos everywhere. The world is a battlefield, and to see that glimmer of hope in the sky of Johnny's return was a cool moment.
Yeah, agreed.
And then we get the kind of the universe's reaction to this whole battle of the four cities and everything that all of Hickman, the writer's threads have been leading towards. We get the return of the Supreme Intelligence, and he wants to negate Earth. He was that big disembodied head that used to rule the Kree Empire and has been, gosh, he's been gone ever since like Operation Galactic Storm, I think.
Wasn't he gone in Annihilation, the first Annihilation?
Oh, right, because he had come back and then he was lost.
He'd come back, and then I think when the
he's got a regular
cycle. Or shortly after when Annihilus attacks the Nova Corps and Richard's the only one left, I think that's when he's gone and it puts it in his head, right? Isn't that when that happens? But he's been gone for what?
No, well, the Supreme Intelligence is different than world mind of the Nova Corps.
Right, but it was contemporaneous, I thought. I thought it was fairly – it was kind of like he died and also the world mind couldn't kind of stay on their home base. Anyway, long story short is, yeah, he hasn't been around for a while and he's not very happy.
But he did –
he's ugly.
He was reconstituted but out of two – of the alternate reads in the FF title, in the Future Foundation title.
Yeah, totally weird.
So now this Supreme Intelligence has four eyes, instead of two eyes, and that's because the two Reed heads had merged.
Nutty. And very much like the Fear Itself plot line in a way, the Supreme Intelligence wants to do to the Earth what Odin wanted to do. He wants to scorch the Earth. It's like time to get rid of this thing. And it all has to do with the fact that the Inhumans were birthed here and Black Bolt, etc. And, you know, the Inhumans basically left the Kree hanging after ruling them for a few years.
Haters!
Although which leads to Ronan being a boss and awesome, and that's been a great development over the last couple of years. When I first saw the wedding between Crystal and Ronan, it was kind of weird, but over the last couple of years they've used that very well.
There was that dramatic moment where she chose to stay with her husband over returning, you know, to Atalan and leaving the Kree with the Inhuman royal family. I thought that was really cool. And similarly here, he gives her the respect back. He can't follow through on the Supreme Intelligence's orders to push the button, literally, because it's Crystal's home planet.
Yeah, and Hickman owes Abnett Lanning a beer or two, because they did all the legwork on that, because it started out where it was arranged, then there was mutual respect, you know, then there was admiration, and then over a couple of years, it just turned into something awesome, and then Hickman just takes her off the shelf and says, thank you, Ronan.
Well, I guess we're finally seeing why the Marvel Cosmic Annihilation line of sequels and stuff kind of came to a halt, is because all these threads were going to come together in Fantastic Four.
You think that's why?
I do. I think that, you know, a few years ago at one of these meetings where they're all sitting around, it's like it's time to return these concepts to the Fantastic Four, because a lot of these things are what made that book so great. Let's bring it back, and we'll take it from there. And Abnett and Lanning seemed like they were happy to go street level, and the results were enjoyable for the most part.
Steven Raker, this is why I love you. That was good. That, you know what? Yeah, you've got me a little bit closer to the camp of the Hickman right now.
So you think Nova being gone was because Hickman wanted Johnny to be the new quote-unquote Nova, kind of the young, because I mean those guys are just like clones of each other, you know?
I don't know.
He's back, he's got a space. I don't know how this is going to end, but he's got his homies, the Light Brigade, he's got the Annihilation Rod, which you can't walk around Central Park with that, you know? I mean, is this are they going to turn like FF into like not Fantastic Four, but FF into like the actual cosmic kind of book on the sly? That would be awesome. At least for a year or so?
Why not?
I would love it.
At least something would be happening if they did that.
It's true.
Well, okay, well, let's...
Opposed to...
Something's happened here, my man. Okay, so after they kind of debrief and realize that the Kree Armada is hanging out in the orbit like a Star Destroyer, it basically becomes obvious that Johnny is confident enough to deal with it, and the annihilation wave is at his beck and call, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But so that's a lot, and then they basically go and fight Alan. I mean, they actually go. He comes back. They have some chat. He gets his spaceship. He goes and kicks some ass up in space, and then at the very end, when you think, okay, this is going to be a straightforward space battle, you realize that the flaming debris from the fight in space is landing in, you know, Ellis Island or wherever.
Yeah, all over.
That was a good
probably.
Twist.
Yeah, and we've got the Avengers, we've got, you know, Iron Man and Cap and the She-Hulk on the ground, so this isn't totally isolated to the FF. And I thought it was cool how a real good nod back to what we've seen so many times is the portal to the negative zone around the Baxter building, right? And Annihilus is going to come through it and everything. But here's an opportunity where the use of that portal becomes, you know, the Deus Ex, you know, machina. This is the savior here. All of a sudden, that portal opens up, and the annihilation wave comes shooting out of it, and you know, like Old Faithful going off, and you get Johnny again in his confidence and really showing his stuff by having all his armada fly out of the portal. Turns to the guys, and again, reminding us that it's still Johnny. He says, "You guys want to see my battleship?" While he's smiling, you know. Those little nods, I think, are great, and those little moments are very FFE to me.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. And yeah, I did think that 601 was good for those exact reasons, that things happen and that the family's back together again. And notably, it is in the Fantastic Four title that this is happening, right? So I think that's why, I mean, it just, the Fantastic Four title lends to this kind of storytelling. My problem was in the history, the last year of a Fantastic Four-less Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my problem was. And so it seems like in this 601, more happened in 601 than happened in Future Foundation from 1 to about 10 or 11.
That's why I said 601 was my favorite issue in years of FF. Yeah.
There you go. And Steve, when you said that the marketing and the way it was trumped up about Johnny's death could have overshadowed the story, I agree with you there too. And that's unfortunate, but there was no other alternative to get this story, right?
Right.
How else were we going to be able to get this in real time and filter out the whole media circus behind it, which in no small part Marvel had something to do with, because they wanted to push the book. They wanted to trump the sales. So they let it happen, and it just detracted so much from the story and inflamed me, pun intended, that they were losing me from the beginning.
I hear you. You've seen that editorial heavy hand go on the book, and that's understandable. You know, from what I understand, it wasn't even Hickman's idea to have a second book or anything. He had the story, and they decided to chop it up and have the two books go concurrent until Johnny died, and then just have the one book and then the return of the other. You know, that's all out of the writer's hands in this case, from what I'm led to believe.
I hope I'll keep two books going forward. I think as long as Johnny is kind of apart from the family for any extended period of time, I think they should at least see how it sells. I mean, if they can get 50,000 plus on each of these titles, why would it go away?
There's enough story going on right now, that's for sure. Of all of the quote-unquote architects of the Marvel Universe, those group of writers that were labeled that way, I think mm-hmm. Hickman is one who that title is appropriate to. I mean, we know this about him, that he sets up you know, years of storyline in ridiculous detail in these kind of outlines and flow charts, et cetera. So, you know, I really, like I said before, believe that all of this stuff is really coming together. And from the hyperbole that I've heard, this next storyline is the finale of all of those machinations and all of those ideas and threads and everything. So, you know, it's not even, this story isn't even the head, it's the next one.
And yeah, it's interesting to see there's so many people that could be the big bad for the next story arc. I mean, the Kree, Galactus is teased for issue 602 at the end. I think that the split with Ronan and the Kree is telling. I think that's the seed that's going to lead into the last arc, but we'll see. This issue was fantastic, and my favorite line was when Johnny shows up, right, and the Kree sentry say, you know, amending, you know, temporal schedules or something, like, who am I going to kick that, you know, who am I going to beat up first? And Ben says, is that some kind of robot wave asking what time it is? Loved it. I can help you with that. But it was a really good issue. It had some really, I was really happy when I saw the four up in the sky, when Peter like picked up Johnny and was happy to see him. His sister was crying. He shows up and he's confident, and Cap is talking to the horse face guy and calls him son. And then he goes, oh, no, it's not me who's going to do it. It's Sir Johnny or whatever. I mean, it's a lot happens. There's a lot of awesome moments. Ronan, you know, staying with Crystal. Ben stepping on Annihilus's neck like a, you know. I mean,
Bad doggy.
Hold my Annihilus. I mean, this wasn't even an exercise issue, and I thought it was amazing.
One more comment about Johnny's return that I thought really showed what his role was for being gone and returning. It's the hope that he brought when he returned. It's one thing to find that missing member of the team in your family who you thought was lost forever, and you find him emaciated in a cell somewhere or wounded on a battlefield somewhere who we thought was lost forever, but no, he survived by dragging himself to the whatever, you know, drinking, catching water on a leaf and surviving and da-da-da-da-da, whatever. He shows up healthy, with vigor, in control, and with an army behind him. It's like he's the cavalry. And I think that brought a lot of weight to the moment and the issue, just like you said, Chris.
You guys are giving me goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, return to greatness, my friend. okay, FF 13 real quick?
Yeah.
A little less happens here.
Yeah. See?
But still plenty. I mean, this is also written by Hickman and penciled by, from what I understand, new penciler Juan Bobillo, who we've seen in the past. Gosh, I remember him from the slot She-Hulk book as a regular artist on that. And the inker is Marcello Sosa with Chris Sotomayor colors. Bobillo, I really did not like on the She-Hulk book because he really didn't make his characters pretty. And let's face it, the She-Hulk's pretty. And but here, I heard Pat Loika talking about how, oh, Bobillo on this book looks great. So I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go. And jumped into the issue. And all right, I see what he's talking about. On this book, it works. He makes kooky-looking little kids that look more kid-proportioned. And a lot of his background stuff and tech and whatnot, the Dragon Man looks ugly. It works for me.
Chris?
I did not like the art, but the story was interesting enough to get me through. I can appreciate this style of art, but the way he depicted Dragon Man made him look like homeboys from Ghostbusters, the doll. It's like long lost cousin or the purple one. I mean, you're right. Some of the tech is good. Some of the scene where they get to the bridge where there's the Celestials standing guard is good. The kids look like Ashley Olsen. Like it's not good. But at least
Valeria certainly should look like that.
She looks like a creepy little kid. Is what she looks like.
Is what she is.
Exactly what
creepy little kid.
But I like the story, but not too much happened, and the ending was kind of, I don't know, not satisfying. But the thing that I wanted to talk about is the whole twist. I mean, this all would have gone according to alternate Reed's plans if it hadn't been for what Valeria has in her little backpack. And how could he not have foreseen that? I just don't, you know, it's like, didn't he brag to Doom? It's like, no Doom is ever, like, I've ran all the probabilities, you can't get out or some nonsense like that. And she just pulls out the ultimate nullifier and points it at him. And he goes, oh, didn't see that coming. I mean, whatever. Well, I guess it's
that's her power. Her power is to, be the Deus Ex Machina.
She does the unpredictable for sure.
Except that her brother is actually the one who has the power to be the Deus Ex Machina. That ought to be his actual
name.
Superhero name. Deus Ex Machina.
You know, one of the things that Alan and I used to harp about on the boards, on the 11 o'clock comics forums about Hickman's FF that we didn't like was some of his way that he was depicting the kids. I mean, there were times where we were kind of going for it and other times where it was like, ooey. And one of my big things was that Valeria, being a genius kid, was too knowledgeable, that, you know, there's a big difference between being super smart and being super knowledgeable, because knowledge takes time, it takes experience, and a kid her age is still, you know, worried about reaching the table to, you know, reach her dinner on the, you know, and worried about, you know, having her mother clip her nails and things, that there's too much to deal with at that age to be as experienced as she is, to already have that little head filled with all that knowledge. And in these recent FF issues, in this issue particularly, she's seeming more like a super smart kid rather than a super experienced kid. And I don't know if that's being done on purpose or if it's just that I'm coming around or what, but it works more for me here. I'm tolerating her better.
Well, I'm thinking that it serves the story, because Valeria's machinations and what she planned to do from the beginning, which was having Doom included and whatever, that she also blew it. You know, she made the opportunity for the Reeds to come through.
Right.
So everything that's happening now is because Valeria blew it. And I think maybe Hickman had always planned that. I don't know if he was into the psychology of children and saw it the way you did, but it worked out to be the same way, that she had all this knowledge so she could open up the bridge and she could do all this and that, but she didn't have the experience to know that there are some nasty things that can come crawling through and that know a lot more than she does.
Sure.
Yeah, there are so many twists and turns with Valeria that I almost don't know what the intent was. Like, at what point are we past the point of no return, where if Hickman comes in and something amazing happens and Valeria saves the day at the very end, and you're led to believe that it was the plan all along? I think I'm finally past the point where I would believe that. You know, I think with the Reeds coming through, and you know what I mean, because he plays her so vague, right? And with all the meetings with Doom, it's almost, at what point is he just kind of like whispering off panel and just kind of like hoping the reader just believes whatever he pulls out of his hat at the end.
All hope lies with Doom, though.
I know. See, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. It's like, and then at the end of this issue, of course, Reed has his Doom on a leash, Evil Reed, and they go across the bridge to try to get back to the council. I guess this is the last surviving Evil Reed. They flip the script. Valeria flips the script on Evil Reed. Doom is free. Franklin is doing a really good job against the Celestials, but he can only do so much.
And remember, the mission here is that, like, this alternate Reed wants to use the bridge to get back to his own reality, because he's the one with the Infinity Gauntlet from his reality. If he can just get back to his own universe, he could use the Infinity Gauntlet to try to make things better or worse.
What's he trying to fix? Either I'm completely stupid or I forgot the main point. What is he offering to fix with the Infinity Gauntlet?
I don't know that he's offering to fix anything as far as our world is concerned, but he wants to stop those Celestials from killing him.
Yeah.
And they want to wipe out the universe, apparently. And that was the piece that I didn't understand, is where the Celestials went from cleaning up this Council of Reeds mess to now in this issue being referred to as a group of mad Celestials who are going to wipe out our whole universe because one of those Reeds survived in it. That seems like overkill from the Celestials' point of view, but at the same time, I loves me some Celestials, so.
Well, we got more of that coming up.
Maybe they are. Are those Celestials from Reeds? From an Evil Reed's universe?
I don't know which origin it is, what universe they originate from, because they show up at that...
At the bridge.
At the bridge, exactly.
I take it that these are not 616 Celestials. These are some alternative universe group of Celestials that... I mean, there's not that many left in our universe, are there? There's only a few, right? I mean, actually,
there's one in San Francisco,
and there's the one floating around in the edges of space from whatever, I forget what series that was, but these are not like our Celestials, right? These are the Celestials that came from some alternative universe to wrecked house on the council.
Although at one point it was, I think it was during DeFalco's run, FF 400, he had, the Celestials be other dimensional anyway, and they actually dip into multiple universes, but there's a source, that hyperspace, actually the reality where Sue's force fields come from are the same that the Celestials originate from, and that's why she was able to actually harm them at that time. So I don't know if any of that is still canon, but there could just be Celestials that, you know, go everywhere, basically.
Ooh, then can I jump in here?
Of course.
Because you just pushed two buttons for me. The one button was the Tom DeFalco era, and the other button is canon. So in Tom DeFalco's run, we had Ant-Man was a part of the Fantastic Four, right?
Right.
And there's an issue that I was reviewing two nights ago, as a matter of fact, because I wanted to check my facts. And in that issue, there was Scott Lang, Ant-Man, had brought his daughter to the Baxter Building.
Yep.
That was Cassie Lang.
Right.
When she was meeting Roberta, the receptionist.
Yeah.
And another house guest of the Fantastic Four, she was about 8 or 9 years old, right?
Hard to tell, because her and Kristoff had that little romantic-y sort of thing happening. I want to say they were, you know, more preteenish.
But okay. So they were preteenish. So let's say they were 11.
If you want to.
preteen, right? Or 12. 11 or 12, which is preteen.
Sure.
Because 13 is okay. So before 13, there's that 11 or 12.
That's 21.
So
go ahead.
So you brought in that second factor. When Cassie Lang was visiting the Baxter Building, Christophe Vernard was the house guest.
Right.
Right. And he was, okay, maybe 12 at the time. But they were clearly drawn and written as children, even though they were having a flirtation, right?
I'd have to go back to look, but I, you know.
Trust me on this one.
Okay.
Because I was looking at the pages two nights ago. Now, this is good. So now we're in FF13. And who is the man standing there, and I emphasize man, who is the man standing there in Doom's armor but is not Doom?
Yeah.
With the open face.
Right. It's supposed to be Christoph.
It's Christoph Vernard. It's the same boy who used to be a house guest of the Fantastic Four during Tom DeFalco's day. He has grown up. Okay?
Yep, especially with this artist's rendering.
Thank you. And number two, Cassie Lang has gone on to grow up. literally, she is now stature in Young Avengers. She is clearly not a 12-year-old little girl anymore.
Here we go, Chris.
Do you agree with me? I want to know right now if you agree
with Alan.
Me. Thank you.
Now
look to your left. What is Franklin Richards?
It's Franklin's reality warping capabilities.
What is Franklin Richards?
Right.
How old is Franklin Richards? So, yes, I put it out there on Whale Watchers. I'm putting it out here now.
But Franklin was restored back to his young self at the end of DeFalco's run after he was teen Franklin, remember?
Yes, but from teen Franklin. But was he turned back to a 4 or 5 year old?
I remember him standing there on that Paul Ryan cover as a little kid again, with all of that Psylord armor like at his feet because it doesn't fit in him anymore.
Yeah. So he's probably like 5.
I think that was the way of turning the clocks back for him. But since then, he should have grown up too, Alan. I don't disagree with you.
Thank you. And Jonathan Hickman did have a birthday issue for Franklin.
Yeah.
In his run when he was still doing Fantastic Four. So Jonathan Hickman acknowledges that Franklin is having birthdays, but these birthdays are not congruent with his peers.
Yeah, so, I think it's like The Simpsons. He's going to be in fourth grade forever, you know what I mean?
Yes, but now we're talking about, and you guys give Hickman a lot more credit than I have, so I'm going to borrow from the credit that you guys give him. I think Hickman is purposefully, intentionally going to have Franklin retarding his own age on purpose.
Hmm.
And I'm not the first one that says that, because Julian Lytle on the boards had put that in writing as well, and I totally agreed.
but it was a thought that I've had for a very long time. And I think maybe if anybody is going to make that reality into canon, I think Hickman will be the guy.
Do you need to, though? What is it?
Yes. At? Yes, I need to.
Okay.
I need it.
No, I'm saying does Jonathan need to?
Alan, like, why are you shooting flowers at him?
I can see that.
Why are you shooting flowers at Franklin, Alan?
Because I need logic. I've been reading Fantastic Four for too long, and I know I'm getting older. I can't watch Franklin not get older again.
So does this make you happy that Johnny is getting older?
Thank you. Again, thank you. Johnny got older because he spent time in the negative zone. But then I am also aware of the storyline where Reed, Sue, and Ben were in the negative zone. No, out to the Skrull homeworld.
Right.
They got shot with an aging ray.
Yep.
And they nearly died of old age. And then when they were salvaged, Johnny had something to do with it, but I don't know if his was the answer. They went younger than they started out.
Right, making Johnny a little bit older in comparison to them than in previous to that. Yeah.
So, Alan, would this make you happy if at the end of Hickman's run, they age them a couple of years, and Valeria and Franklin go up to Logan's new school for mutants? Does that make you happy?
Ooh, that'd be cool.
No.
They can be like teenagers?
No. They don't have to age them. They don't have to age them for me. Just tell me why they're not aging. And they have a perfectly good reason why they wouldn't be aging. I'll buy it. But don't ignore it for 40 years. That's all I'm asking.
Now, my comment of the shooting flowers at Franklin bit is in reference to the Celestials also determine that there's something with Franklin that he's quite an anomaly in this FF13. So they decide to eradicate him and open up with a full frontal blast of energy at him. But by the time it reaches him, it's flowers. And he questions, why are you guys shooting flowers at me? And all of a sudden there's all roots and things growing on the Celestials, and they are very surprised at this turn of events and decide to, as we have seen happen to Franklin before, he is shut down.
Yeah.
Well, at least they think they are. They think they're shutting him down, but as also has happened to Franklin before, he got better.
Right. And we get Doom staying as sort of the climax of the issue is Reed acting a little closer to character, even though this is alternate universe evil Reed. Mm-hmm. And he decides that he's going to martyr himself and use the ultimate nullifier on these Celestials while the rest of the gang heads back through the gate. And back to Earth, and Doom decides he's going to stay too to make sure that this turkey actually follows through on what he says he's gonna. And I thought it was pretty cute how Valeria kind of didn't want to lose Uncle Doom, and Doom had that moment of realizing it, and I think he was touched too.
Yeah. I thought that was good. So who stayed behind? Just Doom and
Reed.
And Reed, right?
Right. Because he's Doom. He's the destroyer of worlds. What gods dare stand against me, he says, as the issues close out. Very cool.
The crazy ones, and they will. Yeah, I thought it was a good issue. The art was inconsistent for me, not my cuppa. But I, the way it ended, I'm curious where it goes. I'll just say that. Like, I feel much more confident in where Fantastic Four is going than where FF is going. FF kind of seems to be jumping all around. And I followed it through the issue, but now, I mean, is next issue just going to be, I guess, Doom and Reed fighting Celestials? Or is it going to be back on Earth?
We don't know.
See, we'll read next issue. Because it looks like, is that Franklin? Is he still out there? FF14.
I haven't looked at it yet. But at least we know with Hickman that there's a story to be told here. You know, there is a story to be told, and it's going somewhere. So I'm along for the ride.
I am too.
And I think for FF, for its own title, I can dip in and find out what's going on. My major objection in the back year was that it was all that we were getting of the Fantastic Four. And that wasn't enough for me.
I hear you.
Yeah, but I'm good. I like it.
All right, let's go way back and look at our creator spotlight, so to speak, and take a look at fantastic Walt Simonson's run on the Fantastic Four from way back in 89 to
90.
Almost 91, probably, yep. Or into the beginning of 91. It spanned 21 issues from issue 334 to issue 354. There were two fill-in issues, so Walt only wrote 19 of those 21 issues. And with some fill-in artists to help Walt stay on schedule, Walt only drew 13 of those 21 issues.
And he got inked by several guys. I think T-Bear inked an issue or two, Milgram inked an issue towards the end. But there's no substitute for when Walt inks himself.
This is true.
Kidding. No kidding.
I thought this was a run altogether. There were seven story arcs, if you will. A lot of them just two or three issue arcs, which was kind of cool. But I thought the most important thing about the run overall was that he was picking up the FF after, after the Burn run, and then Steve Englehart's work on it for years, and by the time Walt was done with the book, he had brought everything back to the core of the FF by the time it was done. Because when he picks up the book, Ben is human, and his girlfriend, Sharon Ventura, is the She-Thing. And we get her back to human by the time it's all said and done. We get Ben back to being the Thing. We get Reed and Sue back in the book because Englehart had written them out of the book. We get Doom returned being to his appropriate stature. We lose the Burn era Negative Zone uniforms and go back to the old blues. And we get the whole Christoph Doombot world sort of all resolved so that there's just one true Doom again. And that's a lot to do in 20 issues.
Walt made it very clear, especially towards the end of the run, when Doom comes back and takes over for Christoph and the Doombot who thought he was Doom, he kind of editorializes and says, wait, what? What's going on? And he lists all the things that you just talked about, Steve, and said, this makes no sense. Why would Alicia do that? And, of course, spoilers, I don't think we know yet that Alicia isn't Alicia, right?
Right.
That comes up later, right? And I don't know if Walt – but the point is it was pretty clear that Walt wanted to make these moves. I think they weren't editorial. I think he probably floated these and said, look, I want to do this, I want to do that. And I think editorial probably said, that sounds great. But
I mean, he didn't do anything.
I was happy with all of their changes except one. I mean, this is really high level, but I was happy with all of his changes except one. And that's making Ben, and I forget how long it lasts, the weird Rocky Ben. How long does that last for?
Yeah. That only was for the one issue. It was during Englehart's run that he became Pineapple Ben, where he was all spiky.
Okay, that's what I was confused.
And he became really super powered and stuff, and he beat the Hulk with ease because now he's so much more powerful in all this business. and that happens only momentarily in issue 350
when we get there.
So, and it was actually used as a plot device, so suspend your judgment, if you will.
Then I loved it all.
If you can, but I don't know. That was some rough times.
Yeah.
Literally.
After Walt did his historic run on Thor, he bounced over and did the X-Factor stuff for a while, right? And then he wrote the Avengers. And he ended up really having trouble writing the Avengers because it was at a time where Marvel editorial was becoming way more corporate, and people like Mark Gruenwald were high up in the company and real sticklers for continuity. If a character was doing one thing in his own issue, he couldn't be doing another thing in another issue. Everything was really carefully scrutinized and controlled. And for a guy writing the Avengers for Simonson, he was having trouble using characters. He would write, a few issues in and then be told at the last minute, no, you can't use Thor because Thor's in deep space right now over in his old title. It's like, oh, come on. So Walt ended up trying to create an Avengers team. I think this is at around Avengers 300, where there was a whole bunch of characters that didn't have their own books so that he could sort of get away with telling some stories. And Reed and Sue were written out of the FF by Englehart. and not being used. So Simonson thought it would be cool to use Reed and Sue with the Avengers. Unfortunately, editorial decided, after okaying months of plots of Avengers plots with Reed and Sue in it from Simonson, that you know, Reed and Sue need to be back with the FF, and Englehart went off the book. And at around the same time, Walt was complaining about the Avengers thing and saying, listen, if I can only use Reed and Sue for one issue because, you know, you're bringing them back to FF, you know, I can't do this book, this group book anymore. I'm out of here. And then surprisingly, in a you know, a moment of irony, they offer the FF book to Simonson. And he had these storylines with Reed and Sue involved, so he kind of just adapted them to be FF stories, and that's why in the first arc we get Iron Man and Thor from the Avengers in this little time travel arc, because he was these were Avengers stories that were refitted to be part of his FF run.
That is the Fantastic Avengers storyline.
exactly.
Yeah, it was really apparent too, because Thor and Iron Man were in it, but what I thought made it the most obvious that this was a repurposed story, I think, was that Ben and Sherry were so odd pegs, square pegs, round holes. Like, they were so afterthought-ish. And that breaks my heart whenever Ben is just kind of there but not there. That sucks. And,
true.
You know, it really was Reed and Sue with Tony and, you know, Thor.
Right.
Oh, and those three other guys in the sled. I mean, I enjoyed the hell out of that Dark Celestial arc, but the whole time I was reading it, it kind of felt shoehorned and made me a little sad. That being said, 337, the first story, first issue of that storyline, is one of the most tense, awesome, action-packed, crazy issue, you don't know what the hell's going on, issue I've read in a while. I mean, it was amazing. I put that down and said, damn. It was really good.
I thought it was funny that Simonson started writing with 334 and did 334, 335, and 336 that were Acts of Vengeance crossover issues, he didn't draw those issues so that he could start drawing 337, which was the same number issue that he started his Thor run on, which I thought was funny symmetry there. But yeah, this was a crazy issue, and he even appeared in it as a cameo. He drew himself as the husband of one of the FF's friends. That's yeah, right. And he's wearing a little dinosaur t-shirt, so that you know it's Walt.
Those Act of Vengeance, though, that was rough to get myself ready that, okay, this is going to be Walt Simonson's entry and it's going to be good. Because
it was okay. I thought the Rich Buckler art was great because he wasn't aping Kirby anymore.
Yeah.
He was doing his own thing. I thought those issues looked fantastic.
Okay.
Like, you don't think so?
I mean, when I'm waiting for Simonson and I'm waiting for his style, then Buckler's
more commercial
was it was more commercial, a lot more party line, and it was just standard, you know, and it kind of stiff, and then the characters themselves were not exciting at all.
They were
boring. They were Z-list villains.
Yeah,
that was the point. I didn't like it. I never did.
I know, fair.
I had never liked the Acts of Vengeance.
Have the omnibus? I didn't either.
What I thought made it a little dry, although it's interesting looking back, was that there was this the three issue storyline was about the FF giving this like congressional testimony about
standing around in a room just talking, dude.
But what was interesting was that now again after this post Civil War era in the Marvel U, that they're talking about possible superpower registration and ban. So here's Walt kind of touching upon that stuff, 25 years ago.
Wasn't Reed pro registration for the most recent one?
And anti.
Oh, yes, he was.
And anti back then.
Well, that's my complaint about Civil War. One of the big complaints was that Reed was so out of character. That whole.
I thought he was, Ben going to France. Give me a break. Anyway, I thought if you were to condense 334, the three issues into one I think it would have been a funny gag issue because, in my mind, all it is Axe Avengers is supposed to be, what, swapping villains. I haven't read that many, and I haven't read them forever, right? It's swapping villains, right? And say, you strangers on a train with superheroes, right?
Yep.
Ha!
So, nice. But I feel like Doom is like, no. Only I can defeat the Fantastic Four. I am not putting my fish key in the bowl, my keys in the fish bowl, and then someone else take a run at Sue or Reed.
Somebody's got a lot of house parties in the neighborhood.
Only I can do it. So I'm going to send these idiots after them because only I can do it. So it's almost offensive to me. And so that's what the whole thing is, right? Is them trying to give this testimony with all these Z-listers. Mm-hmm. And then basically it boils down to, I really didn't try that hard to get someone bad to get you because only I can attack you and I'm busy trying to take out the Punisher or something, you know, that crossover. But that's what made me laugh. I kind of laugh because it's like Walt Simonson not really doing the Acts of Vengeance like editorial probably was really doing Acts of Vengeance.
Yeah.
He almost did it like a joke. I'm not really going to use real villains.
It was more of an assistant's editor's month than it was an Acts of Vengeance.
And that's what made me smile. That's it. But three issues? Yeah, a little much. A little much.
Yeah.
But then we get that whole time travel. There's a whole thing of parallel Earths, like you said, Thor and Iron Man, and a lot of intrigue. There's these celestial the renegade sleeping celestial that's always been sleeping under the Diablo mountains that was the catalyst for the whole Eternals series back in the 70s from the king himself, Kirby. While he's the dream, he was also called the Dreaming Celestial, and his dreams dreamed the Deviants into existence, and they're kind of serving him and preparing for his awakening, and they've kind of led him to set up Galactus in those famous Burn issues where Galactus is dying and returns to Earth and Reed saves him and catches a lot of heck for that. That Dreaming Celestial placed like a command.
The munchies. Gave him the munchies.
Yeah. But it's a future. So in the far future, he's going to have this suggestion come to fruition in Galactus's brain, and he's going to start consuming the whole universe. And that's the threat that our heroes have to deal with.
And Spock gives him a red matter machine. Oh, wait. I liked it. I thought it was great. Towards I think the second to last issue, I was on the verge of getting a little confused. not confused, but like I was. The first issue was just like tight and tense, and I just blew through it. Towards the end, I had to kind of start taking out a notepad. And no, I'm kidding, but I really enjoyed this arc. I liked the follow on shorter arcs more. This actually was not my. This is probably in the middle of my Simonson run ranking wise, but it was really good, and it was all Simonson, right? I think every issue.
Yep, and this ran from 337 to 341. This was the five issue story arc, and what I thought cool too, and it ties us to what we were talking about earlier with FF13, is that the big finale in 341 involves the FF Avengers group securing the Ultimate Nullifier, and that they gave a purpose to the Ultimate Nullifier is that it's a failsafe that Galactus created to take himself out if he ever came to this point. And Galactus has a moment of clarity, and there's a great Hail Mary pass that Reed makes of the Ultimate Nullifier into Galactus's big maw of a hand, and he sets it off, and then they're racing the effect of the nullifier and racing out of the issue, basically, so because everything's going white behind them.
I did like that. It was good. It was kind of like it was Galactus's cyanide pill in a fake tooth.
Right.
Nice. Nice. That was sweet. Very good.
I forgot how much that story arc basically set the entire tone. Not thematically, but like plot-wise, by bouncing the team all over time. Like, right. I forgot how much, because when you're a kid and you're reading them every month, it's like, oh, you know, they're on a dinosaur island, or oh, they're fighting the Russians. It's when you read them close together, you realize that it's like he had his big story, and then he just like skipped the book down the pond and just bunk, 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 and just told his kind of follow up stories. And you really don't. I mean, except for Doom, that's kind of on its own. It's just kind of this big story and the ripple story arcs after with the Doom thing. Not to go forward too much, but with the Doom storyline thrown in at the end. I kind of love it. It's very 70s era storytelling. I liked it a lot. But
and I get seduced by just Simonson's art, Mr. Visual, that's me. And there are just some shots in the 338s and the 341s of Sue and Reed. There's just this beauty that he gives Sue with this bob haircut.
Oh, so hot.
Short again.
Oh, her hair man, is short you guys again. Like that hair?
Oh, dude.
The way Simonson does it, he really makes it work. It's like a 1950s housewife again.
I don't like that haircut. I like how he draws her like that. Don't like the haircut, but
that's she just looks good. And so like in 341, her hair is kind of just laying on her head, but back in 337 when they take off, there's a little panel where the four of them are lined up, and it's Sue and it's Ben as Ben, and now there's Sue and there's Sharon and there's Johnny and there's Ben as the human Ben. And Sue's hair is all tousled and kind of wiry, but her expression, I mean, it just looks hot.
Her faces are great, I agree. I mean, Walt said that he modeled Sue's likeness to Kimberly Conrad, who was a playmate and Stan's pals, Hugh Hefner's wife during the 90s. You know, the face is good enough and body type and stuff, but I can't co-sign on that hairdo, man. I think it looks like a Star Trek Tribble grew fat and died on her head. It makes her look more like June Cleaver, like you said, a housewife from the 50s, than
exactly.
It does.
And it works.
And that's one of the things that I loved about the DeFalco run that followed up on this and why I tolerated the hot Sue stuff, because she's coming back. They made her a housemaid in some ways that I know the thing is long hair is hard to draw. Byrne cut her hair really short. Everyone wants to cut her hair short because they don't want to draw long hair for whatever reason. But I like her a little younger.
I remember when I was a kid, I hated the Rosebud. I always kind of thought it looked Rosebud silly. Too. But seeing it inside in the internals, the sequential pages, it's awesome. Especially the overhead shot when they first fire off. And you're like looking down, you can see exactly where everyone's sitting. I was like, okay, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, this is the vehicle you're talking about.
This is an awesome vehicle. And it's like, I forgot how awesome it is. And it's tough. Yeah. It's real tough.
But it looks like it's hanging together by, like, you know, tinfoil. I mean, it looks like it's a rickety little thing. There's a lot of space in between it. There's not, you know what I mean? It looks like it's just a little rickety thing doing a big job. That reminds me of like the old. You know, early space missions, what some of those contraptions were like. It's like, oh my gosh.
I like how Thor sits in the back so his cape can flow and not get anyone's face.
That's considerate, I think.
That's why he gets lost at the end. They fall out the back, right? So what happens is they all get home from this big adventure of escaping the ultimate nullifiers effect and save the universe and all that bit. And they think they're home and everything's good, but it becomes obvious that they're actually on a parallel Earth at this point, where Stalin stayed in power, and they end up doing this whole misadventure battling this Stalin's really like a puppet. He's like a disembodied head, but he's being controlled by the political forces at work there. But they get to fight this big mech armor, you know, robot with a Stalin head inside, hoping to fight off a World War III event on this parallel Earth, which was
The vibe of Jeff Bridges in Iron Man 1, like Joseph Stalin. This big.
I loved it
how they – after I read the first arc, I thought, well, they're going home. And then when they went to this – I mean, I remember that Nuke Busters cover so well. That's one of the covers I remember most from this era. This is Nuke Busters. It just made no sense. Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, Nuke Busters. That's this one. I was really
impressed. What number?
This is 343 and 344. And I should have mentioned at the top of our segment here that these are all collected in three trade paperbacks, FF Visionaries by Walt Simonson, Volume 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, I didn't know
three.
That. I have the originals.
Oh, yeah.
I got them both because I wanted to see it on white paper.
Fair enough. I wonder if they're going to do – you know what? This would be a good omnibus. 20 issues, 19, 20 issues or whatever, 21 issues. That'd be a nice –
In these Visionaries, too, they throw in some good back matter. They throw in Simonson's pinups from, like, the Marvel Illustrated swimsuit issues of the day and a Marvel Age cover and an article that he did. It's a good little set of collections.
Yeah, my thoughts on this, I don't know about what you think, Alan, but I thought a couple things were funny. I thought it was a little editorializing by Walt where Alicia is still with Ben, a little foreshadowing what kind of he says outright a couple issues later.
Yep.
In the alternate universe that Alicia is still with Ben. And I was really impressed he fit this whole arc into two issues.
Yep.
So much happens. Mm-hmm. Two issues. And then the last thing I thought was kind of funny was, according to Joseph Stalin, Reed is the most dangerous of all of them. I don't know. I thought it was funny. I don't know. Does anyone ever think that Reed is the most dangerous? Except for Doom? Really?
Doom?
Yeah. Who else? Nobody.
We all know it's Sue. We all know Sue's actually the
most
dangerous.
We all know Sue's the most dangerous.
Oh, of the four, not of the just the oh, world the and his intellect.
Yeah, of the four. Who's the most dangerous of the
four? Okay. Yes.
What I think is funny, too, as you mentioned about the Alicia bit, is that over the whole arc, the whole run that Simonson had, he really doesn't touch upon Alicia and even acknowledge Alicia and Johnny's relationship barely at all, except for one moment in the Art Adams in the new FF thing where someone takes expresses that Nebula took her visage to capture him. But
that Walt doesn't like that, does he? I think Walt really does not like Alicia being with.
It was getting back to square one. Let's not even acknowledge it. I'm not going to undo it, but I'm not going to acknowledge it either.
Because who would like that? Why did they ever do that? Why did Byrne ever do that?
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if it was intentional or not, but in the Acts of Vengeance issues. Of course, Walt has to talk. Has to have Franklin begging to go see the dinosaurs, right? and they never go, right? They never go. Mm-hmm. And then they drop them off at the Sitters, and then when they land on Dino Island, Franklin's not with them. I think that's ironic, just a little.
And that's the next arc, and is the next two-issue arc.
Sorry, yeah.
In 345 and 346, and that's the Dino Island. And here Walt Simonson finally gets to draw his dinosaurs. For a guy who loves dinosaurs, he barely ever has stuck them in his comics. And he really gets his fill.
He draws a Spinosaurus, Triceratops.
Yes.
And I think, like, raptors. I couldn't tell what the other ones were. But, yeah, I thought this was like a Reed Richards stalker from G.I. Joe team up on Dino Island. I loved it. It was my favorite arc he did. I know that seems weird, but it just was.
It's the FF depowered on an island with a group of soldiers, and on the island is a bunch of dinosaurs. So they're just trying to survive, basically, and get off the island, but the island's shrinking. There's a cool backstory to it that Simonson tells, that he had in an issue of Thor researched a friend of a friend's group of soldiers and an army unit, I believe, and wanted to use their names and their rank and their unit number and all that stuff, and thought that he did, but he got it all wrong, apparently. He had the wrong nicknames with the wrong actual soldiers' names and stuff, and he wanted to do it right for these guys. So he talks about this storyline as being paying off an old war debt, and he gets it right this time. He uses those same soldiers from that old Thor issue, but this time gets their names and nicknames and unit numbers and everything correct.
Check it out. Okay. I accept. I keep looking at Sue. She's just so... I love that haircut.
Ah, you're killing it.
She's cute.
I didn't read 346. It's the only one I don't have.
Oh.
I know. Kind of sad. So I don't know how the story ends. I don't remember.
They get off the island.
Thank you.
I love how they're depowered, so Ben's suit becomes relevant, because they're going to be dino food. Well, and then Ben breaks out his suit and wrecks house. I just love that. It's just it's kind of long time coming, because he really doesn't do that much in the first three arcs, and now we get to see Ben kind of step up. I like that.
And that's another great old nod to the old again around that time when Alan and I started reading is the thing suit, the robotic thing suit.
Love it. That was old school. That's right. When that first show up, FF39.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't
remember.
Is that
FF39 where in the cover there's Doom like in the skyline, and you see like the Fantastic Four with Daredevil kind of like sulking, walking down the street, and you see the Thing.
I know that cover.
Behind him, you see Ben holding a remote control. Isn't that that?
Huh. I remember it when Ben was depowered in the 70s, and they had to get Luke Cage and hire him to join the FF to get a little muscle.
That's right.
Then they built Ben the exoskeleton suit.
Because I think he's been depowered like, what, 7 times?
Oh, sure. it's a very FFE thing, but this brought that whole time travel. It was really a grand arc. It ended up being like 9 issues, a kind of a 3-act story, everything really changed course for the next 3 issues, because in 347 through 349 we get the legendary classic new FF storyline that was written by Simonson with Art Adams art.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Stuff.
We gotta talk about this.
And T-Bert Inks, I should say.
We gotta talk about this.
Yes. And there's little Franklin. Oh man, you talk about cute. Ridiculous.
Love the Art Adams, guys.
This was the first time when I read this. First time I ever read Art Adams.
Cool.
And I just looked at his art ever. I have to say though, 347 and 348 are two of the favorite covers I had growing up, and I had those on my wall for a long time, and I can't pick. It's like two sides of having two kids, 347, 348. one, they're not moving at all, but it's just so much going on, and the other one is the new FF, jumping down. But I love these issues. I was a little bummed out that Art Adams didn't do the full 3-issue arc. I thought it really showed Rhea pencil assists in the last 2 issues.
I thought it was more just backgrounds and stuff, though.
Well, then maybe it was the inker, but the faces all looked off.
Yeah, it's true. There is a difference.
There was a difference. I mean, hey, it was still Art Adams, but I love this art. This is just pure Shakespeare, just tons and tons of misunderstandings, 4 or 5 groups all kind of coming together, like on the stage, and just kind of pointing fingers everywhere, and no one knows what's going on. And you've got, a woman dressed as a man, dressed as a woman, dressed as a man, or it's awesome.
Hey, wait, is this Bob Layton's Hercules, or
As You Like It?
Yeah. Well, let's catch the gang, the listeners up though, as to what this new FF is. I'll drop a little history on you. This is also a very Assistant Editor's Month type of storyline where Simonson was basically joking around with Carol Kalish, one of the marketing gurus of Marvel in the 80s and 90s, and someone who worked on her staff at the time, which was Kurt Busiek, and they were chatting about marketability and stuff, and saying that it would be hilarious to have I think Simonson wanted to have Spidey guest star. And then because Spidey was so popular at the time, Busiek threw in, well, why don't you just have the Punisher and Ghost Rider and Wolverine too, since they were crossing over into every comic at the time. They were the most popular and saturated in the Marvel books in the early 90s. And Simonson took it as a joke and then later the wheel started turning, and he's like, yeah, this could work, and this could be a real gas. And he needed a break on the pencils to catch up, so he got Art Adams to draw it. They were old friends, and Art Adams wanted nothing to do with drawing the Punisher. He's like, that doesn't interest me at all. Simon said, who would you want to draw then? And he said, how about the Hulk? So that's the new FF, Wolverine, Spider-Man, the Ghost Rider, and the Hulk, the Gray Hulk. He said, Simonson said, what else do you want to draw? Art, he said, I want to draw Kirby Monsters. So yes. That's how we got the Mole Man and Monster Island, and again, really pointing Art Adams in a direction and launching him in appropriate ways to get him to draw the stuff he wants, and good stuff at that.
How contemporary was that with Longshot and that whole series? Was he
a few years after?
Okay.
A few years after. Because this is why I had gotten back into reading comics right at the time when Simonson started writing FF, and Longshot happened while I was gone in
86, right? 85, 86, something like that.
It would have to be 86. I stopped reading like mid 85 ish.
Alan, what do you remember? Did you like this? I mean, this is kind of a big, for me, this was huge. But as far as kind of like storylines go, kind of a abrupt end to. Kind of what Simonson been doing, and I even felt the scripting, I felt the writing was different. Like, I don't know what it was, but it flowed much quicker. It was a different style of writing I thought Simonson had. I don't know, maybe that's just me, but I like this arc. I like it more for the art than for the story. I mean, the monsters and, you know, the beautiful art. The story was just kind of. I don't even know if Delilah comes back. Is she important? I don't remember her. Did she come back up?
Delilah is,
She's a Skrull?
The all of these people are running around chasing their tails because of
one
Skrull hippie,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. She wants to get this, Skrull war bot, and, that is usually reserved for serving the queen, the Skrull queen.
Yeah.
And they are birthed like a living being and immediately imprint on the first thing they see and protect it for life. So they are birthed in the Skrull queen throne room and see the queen and then protect her for life, which doesn't help if Galactus comes and eats the Skrull throne world.
Exactly.
But, so at the very end, unfortunately for her, her plans go awry because this thing hatches, this warbot, and imprints on the famous giant mole man monster from FF1. And it's like mommy, and they're going to have it. And even the mole man's like, can't get in between that. You know, he can't get his hands on it either. And the Ghost Rider decides to give Delilah the penance stare. So the last thing we see of her is she's shaken on the ground, discombobulated.
Yeah, I didn't do my homework. I don't remember if she ever becomes important again in any future storylines.
Not that I recall.
Not at all.
And what was the funniest thing at the end, I thought, was they slipped the Punisher in on a little cameo.
Yes, they do.
Art Adams was willing to draw the Punisher doing a flyby, saying, oh, I guess I don't need to get involved here. And even on the cover, they hype it as the most...
exploitative.
You know, right. The worst cameo ever.
It was pretty funny. I'm on my way to Columbia. All right, detour. Yeah, I thought... I really liked it. I thought it was an interesting twist. You kind of got to see what was in Walt's head where... Delilah, who's a telepath, shows up as what she thinks is the object of desire for the victim when she slips the Mickey to everybody, right, at the beginning.
Yeah. And she's a
she shows
telepath.
Up as Nebula instead of Alicia
right.
for Johnny,
right.
because who likes Alicia and Johnny together? And then for Ben, shows up as Alicia. Actually, I don't remember now.
Yeah, Alicia.
Alicia, right? Yeah.
Yep.
And then for Sue, Alan, who's she
showing? Namor.
Hell no. And then for Reed, shows up as
Sue,
right? It's yep. I was kind of pissed.
So, yeah, right?
But it was saucy Sue. She she was getting into Reed's head a little bit because she was a low-level telepath, so she was kind of cajoling him mentally, and he was starting to fall for this little bit more risque Sue.
Well, we know what's really good. I mean, Sue isn't always mommy. Come on.
Well, at least twice.
Just looks like it with that hairdo.
You need to watch some more like Beach Blanket Bingo. You need to watch some Annette Funicello. Like that hairstyle does not stop the sauciness.
I like longer hair.
Okay. Yeah, this is
on my women's at least.
Here's the big issue.
How do you like your men?
Orange and Rocky.
Ah, well, we've got him here. Right here he is.
So what's the big one, Chris?
The big one, 350. This is the one I got signed by Walt when I saw him. I love this issue. Oversized. And this is kind of I think this is where he starts putting the house in order, right? I mean, this is it.
Yep.
I mean, so what we have is 350 is basically kind of a swerve at the beginning, and you have the Christoph Doom kind of struggle, but then there's a swerve, and actually a third Doom shows up, and that's the real Doom. And the other Doom was simply a Doom bot who thought he was Doom. And Doom yells, Ouroboros! And Christoph goes, what? I see a cloud lifting. Oh, it's you, Master. And then with that little utterance, all is right in Latveria. Doom is back. And then basically Doom's kind of pissed off. He goes through a litany of all the things that he's annoyed with editorially. I mean, with the FF. and decides, Sharon Ventura, I don't like her. I like Ben. Well, not really. And decides to kind of use her as bait to try to trick the FF to, reliving FF17.
Right.
Where he basically just sets death traps for them. Even down to the random bars going in all directions for Sue, and it's just a great episode. I mean, or issue. I hate when I do that.
I love it
because I mean, clearly you get Doom back, you get Ben back, no more suit. I'm very happy. So
this is the 90s by now. So this was Walt's way of letting the reader decide because he never puts any weight into what appearances he thinks are canon or, you know, are the real Doom or not. But this lets the reader decide that any appearance of Doom that didn't seem up to par in the last 30 years could have been a Doom bot, not the real Doom. He says that Doom's been away. He's been to the far reaches of wherever trying to, you know, collect knowledge and power. And he only comes back from time to time. And this lets the reader say, if I like this appearance by Doom, it was the real Doom. If I don't like this appearance by Doom, it was a Doom bot. And he cleans the slate on the Christoph stuff at the same time, which I thought was great.
Yes, agreed. Really like this issue.
Yep. And the ironic thing is, you know, while he's turning Sharon Ventura back into human from this she thing, succeeding where Reed has failed yet again, he also secretly probes her mind and collects as much info on the FF as he can. So it's not all benevolent on her part. And then at the same time, Ben turns himself back into a thing because of the she thing and her self image issues. So you've got her, you know, the star-crossed lovers there. They will they ever get it right, you know?
Right, like the gift of the Magi.
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's at the end of this issue, Chris, where the thing, because he has turned himself back into the thing and sort of evolved back into the thing, it's in a moment where he's battling Doom that he goes Pineapple again.
Yeah.
And this Doom has been away. He's never seen Pineapple Doom or Pineapple Thing. So, or the exponentially increased strength that goes along with this, the pineapple-y thing. And he, like, crushes Doom's hands, and Doom's totally about to lose this whole battle. And Sharon Ventura comes up from behind and power staffs Ben in the back to free Doom up. I guess she owes him one. It's never really said why she
decided to help. No, I had no idea why she did that. I think it's because she was... She was confused.
She's coming out that, or she kind of wanted to be human again, and Doom made her human.
Right. So she owes him one.
Maybe she felt like she owed him for that.
But right after that, in the net, you know, she's back to being lovey-dovey with Ben, so it's not like she disliked Ben. So it seemed odd, but at the same time, it moved the story where it needed to go. And it, right after that, in the next dish, that we see Ben return to his, you know, the familiar form of the thing. So yeah, that lumpiness was returning to Pineapple was just to have that moment of surprise on Doom, I think.
Yes.
And then this is a two-parter, though there was a fill-in issue in between, so it was a long wait if you were reading the book monthly. But 350 ends with Reed showing up, and then it's not until issue 352 that we get the final showdown between Reed and Doom. And this is the very clever battle through time that they do in the issue, where there's an 18-page battle sequence that skips around the issue with little time stamps, including the cover, and if you read it front to back, you get a story, but if you also follow those little time stamps like an old Choose Your Own Adventure book, you also get it. It all falls into place that way sequentially. Very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, like nice. I like the wrinkle of that, you know, the whole time conundrum and how he basically let himself out of the trap.
Right, from the previous issue.
You lied to me. You let yourself out of a trap. It was the whole which came first. Fun stuff. Yeah, I like
but
this.
Throughout that whole thing, he's still Pineapple-y, though.
Right, at the end.
When does he stop being Pineapple-y?
At the very end, he's restored, right?
Oh, okay.
It's got to be in the cross time. It's in the last arc. I'm sorry. Because he stays Pineapple-y into the final two-issue arc of his run. It's at the very end of that he's restored when they return to Earth. And so let's – anything more on the Doom and the Time bit?
They were naughty, and someone noticed.
So the last arc is the Time Variance Authority arc, and that is issues 353 and 354. And this is the FF dealing with this huge intergalactic bureaucracy that was a metaphor for what Marvel had become at the time. It's just all middle management. You never get to see upper management. You never get to know what they're really doing or if they even matter. They're just managing.
The eternal room of the desks.
Yeah,
just receding into infinity forever.
Exactly, and the face of the middle management is like a cloned Mark Gruenwald, and he was in on the joke. He thought it was great that Walt was using him for that. He even let Walt photograph him from a couple angles so he could get his likeness. But the FF are escorted to the Time Variance Authority, the TVA. Like the old Tennessee Valley Authority from deal. But they're escorted, I thought it was cool, by Justice Peace, who was the time cop, if you will, that was introduced back in Simonson's Thor run. So it's cool that he used him again.
All right. Yeah.
He also blows away Christoph. He kind of, again, kind of closes the chapter on that whole false Doom thing. But we know that Christoph didn't end up dying after all, thanks to DeFalco's run. But in the TVA, there are a few little gags. One of the panels shows one of the middle management men discarding of old disposed universes that are no good anymore. And these books are a few years after DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths, and you see a little Supergirl being thrown into the trash because she was one of the casualties of that event and the DCU being restarted.
She was the iconic image.
Yeah.
draped in Superman's crying arms.
With the I thought it was a nice way to wrap up his run.
Yeah, the last issue, 354, is just a wild ride, literally. They're on the Cross Time Express. It's like a great train escape where they're riding this train out of of the TVA reality and back home, and Justice Peace is on top of the train. He's trying to take them in, it's when they do return to our reality, their fare ends up being their costumes, because that material is worth a pretty penny, and they return to Earth in their underwear, and that's when Ben rephases back to his smoother, lumpy look.
And all is right with the world.
Right.
That kind of level of adventure, and you put a family in there, that's the thing that makes the Fantastic Four for me, right? See, like,
yes.
just the cover alone, just the cover alone of 354, you have Sue, who is she's a wife to me, especially with this haircut. Okay, calm down, Steve. Calm down. Here's a parallel that I have for you. Maybe it'll help you understand where I'm coming from with this. So Doctor Who, right? The thing that I like about Doctor Who, the show, is that you have this nearly omniscient genius alien that looks like a human riding around this miraculous machine. And who do you have to accompany him, his companions, who are usually an airline stewardess, every everyday person, just a you or a me, is his companion. So to me, when I look at Fantastic Four, okay, I see the egghead who is a super genius, and I see the hotshot pilot, young boy who was raised on sports cars, and he's got a go-get-it attitude. He likes to fly, and he goes, Ben is the jock, and he's the this, and he's the that. And then you've got Sue. I feel like Sue is an everyman character. She's the girl who was in love with the guy and took a spaceship ride up in the stars and came down altered forever, and she's hanging out like, okay, this is me now. What am I going to do? I'm going to keep these people together.
Yep.
I'm going to be the voice of reason.
She's a den mother. Hot den mother.
Regardless of the fact that, one, she's hot, and two, that she's the most powerful, regardless of those things, her personality is just this everyman character clinging on to the impossible going on around her.
Even though she's female, she's the one that you can relate to the most in these fantastic environments that the FF have been in over their publishing history.
Even from when,
for me,
even when Jack was doing the book, even as early as then, whenever Sue was gone, whether she was kidnapped or whatever, or when she left the first time,
yep,
it's just, you could see they just fell apart. I mean, you know, Reed would get facial hair and get grumpy, and then when Magneto steals her and they go underwater and all that crap, is without her there, things get rough. They get like roid rage, or they get mopey, or they turn into a bunch of pissy teenagers. So I agree, she's the glue, and that's why I kind of liked it. That's why I like Byrne's run. Because if you really read the first 50 issues or so, she serves no function.
Yep.
In my opinion.
Well, she gets captured a lot. You know, she gets captured a lot.
You know, I think, I agree, Alan. I dig what you say, man. I agree. She's, Ben is the tough guy. John's the fun guy. Reed's the smart guy. And she is the every woman.
I think as we meet, again and again, and look at these different eras of FF's publishing history, I think she'll be the character that it will be most interesting to compare and contrast how she's presented during those different runs. You know, everyone else pretty much has a gestalt that is maintained, but Sue seems to be where there's some room for sort of using her differently, and she has been presented differently over the years. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
Agreed. Well, hey guys, this was fun. We covered a lot of stuff, lot of awesome stuff. I'm really glad that we could talk, and I hope anyone listening enjoys this, because I think between the three of us, we have about 75, 80 years of Fantastic Four reading history.
Fantastic Four cred.
Yo.
All right, gang. Thanks for doing this, guys. This was fun. We'll meet again in another 4 to 6 weeks or so after there's another couple of issues of FF and Fantastic Four to come out, or another issue, I should say, and we'll read them, and we'll get our thoughts together, and we'll share them again with just as much verve as we did this time.
Gladly.
Yes.
All right, gang. So until Galactus goes back on his word and feasts upon this here Earth, yum, yum, make mine Marvel. Later.
Thank you, Pat, for the X Talk, and thank you, Steve, and Alan, and Chris, for the FF Talk. It's been a while since, well, I have yet to read any FF, but Fantastic Four, I think, well, the McDuffie run was the last time I was buying it month in, month out. Tried the first couple issues of the Miller and Hitch stuff, and I tried the first couple issues of the Hickman Eaglesham stuff, and well, it's been a while since I've been current on my Fantastic Four. Maybe when I am looking for something else to read or the guys convince me, I might give the current stuff a shot. But just kind of really haven't been feeling it. So I'm looking forward to future Foresight segments, and we'll see. Maybe they will convince me. Stranger things have happened. I have been, however, speaking of an era that's from the past, I never really read a whole lot of Kane, one of Peter Parker's clones, and I recently read Scarlet Spider number one, and I really, really enjoyed it. This is one where, mostly, I was going to get this because of Ryan Stegman pencils. It's written by Christopher Yost and inks by Michael Babinski, and it is it looks great. It absolutely does, and I like what Chris Yost is doing with Kane's, I guess, internal dialogue. There are a couple things that were a little confusing that I wasn't clear on, because, like I said, I've read very little Kane ever since he's existed, from back in the day, and the Clone Saga, and I guess recently, you know, Spider Island is where I kind of read the bulk of my Kane stories, and he really wasn't even Kane during that; he was Tarantula. But this is one I'll be sticking with for the time being. I really, really enjoyed it. Where I was a little confused was the whole Mark of Kane bit, I guess, since that wasn't, I mean, obviously there was no razor in his hand when he shaved off his beard and trimmed his hair. It's kind of obvious what he was doing. You know, he didn't exactly have a handful of Nair on him, but it's there was just a couple things maybe here and there that just, not being a longtime Kane reader, that wasn't too clear to me. But that said, I thought it was a great setup, because we are finding out about this character. We realize he does not have a spider sense. He does have some abilities that Peter Parker has. He has the organic webs, which thankfully Peter Parker no longer has. He has the he has the ability to, I guess, communicate with spiders or insects. He does have the enhanced strength. He can stick to things. So there are some things that he does have in common with Peter Parker, and a couple things that are kind of new or different, I'll say, from Peter Parker and are unique to the Kane. And I think it's gonna be interesting to see him in Houston. you know, he's obviously he has an agenda. He has his own plan, but I guess things get sidetracked, and I guess you really can't run from being a hero. I would have liked to have seen the hero of the story in his suit, in his outfit, in his uniform, whatever you want to call it. We did not see the Scarlet Spider. We saw the mask in his duffel bag, but as far as the first issue goes, we see Scarlet Spider on the cover, and on the cover to the next issue from the letters page, but we do not see our hero, in quotes, our hero fit for duty, I guess we'll say. He's not all dolled up, but that said, we still he has a mission now, more or less. We'll call it that, and I want to see where it goes. I am really enjoying it so far, and I know it's only been one issue, so really you either do or you don't. But I'm going to stick with it for now. I really have no complaints, other than I'm just not. I guess I would have liked maybe a Kane primer included with the issue, we'll say. Amazing Spider-Man 677 and Daredevil number 8 were, that was a two-part story, one crossing over into the other, titled The Devil and the Details. And this was written by Mark Waid across the board. Mark Waid did the one issue of Amazing Spider-Man, and of course, writing Daredevil. It involved Spider-Man and the Black Cat. It involved theft. It involved Horizon Labs. Really funky two-parter, and just kind of, it was one of those things where it reminded me of the stories I read back in the day where you just had two heroes kind of just, you know, they one showed up in the other's title, and it was kind of like an impromptu Marvel team-up, we'll say. It wasn't, you know, there was no grand plan to have these two meet. There was no fight, and then they realized the misunderstanding of any team-up. It was just, hey, I need your help. Okay, let's do this. And that's what they did. Great conversation between Spider-Man and Daredevil. I really like them as a team. I like them when they pair them up. But it's but I can kind of get where Daredevil gets his way of thinking with not wanting to team up with Spider-Man. But I guess if you end up the way Daredevil does in the last couple of pages of this issue of Daredevil, I guess there are rewards when you team up with Spider-Man, and I guess to the victor. Go to the spoils, because he looked quite happy he was happy, and then he received a phone call from Foggy, and I'm not going to really go into it spoil the issue or talk about what the whole purpose of the team up was, other than the theft I mentioned earlier. And I'm not going to tell you about the framing sequence, I'll call it, the story or the plot that's kicking off the issue of Daredevil and ends the issue of Daredevil. I'm not going to mention it at the moment. And I also read Amazing Spider-Man 678. It was just a Spidey kind of day. I won't even talk about Avenging Spider-Man right now. We'll save that for another time. But Amazing Spider-Man 678 is a more or less a time travel story. It's something happens in the future, and Peter Parker, or Spider-Man, has to prevent it from happening. There's an appearance by Silver Sable. Again, Horizon Labs. We see some of the other members of the think tank in this issue. Beautifully illustrated by Humberto Ramos, and of course his inker extraordinaire, Victor Olazava on inks, and Edgar Delgado on colors. This was just a this was a Spider-Man story. It felt like a little grander as far as what Spider-Man has to do to save the day, but still, it was for a first issue, for a first part of two, it was quite. I dug it. I really did. I mean, I've been on a big Spider-Man, amazing Spider-Man kick lately. I'm a little confused about the whole time travel and things like that. It I guess it wasn't as clear as they make it out to be in like Star Trek or Doctor Who. But here, I was a little confused, but it didn't detract. It didn't take away anything from my enjoying the story. And before I forget to give credit where it's due, I mentioned Mark Waid was the writer. Emma Rios was the artist on Amazing Spider-Man 677, and the art on Daredevil was done by Kano and Javier Rodriguez colored both issues. But yeah, that's it, you know, like I said, it's been a Spidey kind of past few days for me, and I really, you know, I'm going to go out on a high note. I'm going to end it with the good stuff. I'm not going to talk about Ghost Rider, we'll say. All right, a little bit. I am, my Ghost Rider is Johnny Blaze. I've been a fan of his for, I mean, I remember buying the last issue. I read the last issue. I think it was 81, and then I finally tracked down 80. But I would read some Ghost Rider issues here and there. And I enjoyed Johnny Blaze as the Spirit of Vengeance. And then I remember picking up a couple of issues of the run from the 90s that was kicked off with art by Javier Soteres and Mark Teixeira, and I believe Mackie was the writer. Howard Mackie, who's now going to be writing for DC. But the I don't know, I Danny Ketcher is cool and all, but it was the 90s and things were violent and gritty, and I mean you had the Punisher and everything and Wolverine. Well, it's kind of hard to really tell you how Wolverine became overexposed back in the day when he's in 8 out of 12 issues every week, but things were just different back in the 90s, and the Ghost Rider looked cool and all, but it wasn't really my Ghost Rider, the Ghost Rider I enjoyed, and then Johnny Blaze showed up, and that wasn't the Johnny Blaze I remembered. They obviously have to change things, and if Danny Ketch was your Ghost Rider or was when you were introduced to Ghost Rider, then I mean, then that's usually how things work. And I'm glad we got some Johnny Blaze in this Ghost Rider, in the early issues of this current Ghost Rider, but I'm just not feeling Alejandra, and I don't know, something there's also really not been a... The consistency's been a little off visually. There's we have Matthew Clark, and then we have Lee Garbett, who's of course a fantastic penciler, and then there was a fill-in issue before Clark finished the first arc, and now there's this other artist in this current arc I'm reading where she's down in the bayou, and she seems to be everywhere. She's out west and she's down south, and it's not cohesive. It's not there's no thread really connecting at all that I'm seeing yet, and it's kind of hard for me to just give the benefit of the doubt or hope that there's a payoff. I was kind of just maybe going to stick with this while we get to the Venom in air quotes event, the 13 and the 13.1 through 0.4, because that was that looks like a pretty interesting crossover. I'll say not really a crossover. I mean it's a Venom thing, and it's in his title, and it involves Red Hulk and Ghost Rider and Venom. I'm going to check that out. I definitely want to check that out. But I was kind of hoping maybe to get a little bit more of a feel for this current Ghost Rider. And I just kind of not. It has nothing to do with it being a female. It has nothing to do with you know, dealing with the devil or it just, it kind of came out of the gate. And I don't know if I could say it was because it was a Fear Itself kind of tie-in when it started, but it just, it's having trouble finding its footing with me. I'll just leave it at that. But if you are digging it, if you're reading it, if you're enjoying it, let me know. Tell me. Let me know what I'm missing. Let me know what you're enjoying about it. That's all. I'm going to continue reading my Spider-Man because I kind of know what I'm getting with that. It's going to be fun. But I kind of just, I like the character. I like Ghost Rider, and I want to like Ghost Rider. But this one kind of hurts a little bit. And Magneto, not a hero. There we go. Ending on a high note. We have Magneto versus Magneto. I don't want to. Well, you know what? The solicits might have given it away. Joseph's back, and Joseph is not a character that I'm familiar with a whole lot. But it's going to be interesting to see this play out. The second issue I read this past week, and I really enjoyed the first issue. Great setup by Scotty Young and Clayman, and I kind of enjoyed the flashback from at the beginning of the second issue and catching us up and having Magneto. I guess I liked the first issue more, mostly because visually we only had one art team throughout the issue and we had some Cyclops in the issue. I ain't gonna lie, but I really am enjoying Magneto, not a hero, and I want to I wish Scotty the best. I want to see this finish off and see what else we have lined up. There was a part where Joseph and Eric are having a pretty interesting conversation about Eric's current not state of affairs, but his current station in life and where he fits and why he's doing what he's doing. And I think that alone in the second issue, I think that made it worth my while. Just those couple of panels on that page. And I was really, really happy to see that in that issue, you know, but it was a pretty good moment right there. So I'm done rambling. I've done it enough to wrap this up. I don't want to, sully the good work of the other gents earlier in the episode. So I'm going to say goodnight, say goodbye. Hope everybody has a great week. We'll be back soon. And, well, just take care, everybody. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
lose your mind. Make sure that you only take one at a time. Better slow it down, don't pick up the pace. That shit'll make you fall flat in your face. Moonshine pieces make you lose your mind. Make sure that you only take one at a time. Better slow it down, don't pick up the pace. That shit'll make you fall flat in your face. Moonshine peaches
make you lose your mind.
Moonshine peaches
take one at a time.
Moonshine peaches
don't pick up the pace.
Moonshine peaches
fall flat on your motherfucking face. Shit'll make you fall flat on your face.
Moonshine peaches
make you lose your mind.
Moonshine peaches